Hey, and thanks for listening. This is Conversations, the True Voice Media podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Gibbard. Let's get started. This is episode 26 of True Voice Media Conversations. It's our podcast. I'm Jeff Gibbard. I'm your host. And today with me, I have Q Xavier. The smooth sounds of Q Xavier. Q, who has been on our podcast before, is back for round two. And let's start it off right by asking Q the question that everybody needs to know. Q, who are you and what do you do?
Hi, everybody. I am Q Xavier, as Jeff has so eloquently announced to everybody. I go by Q. What do I do? My work is at the intersection of research and content. So think strategic planning layered over content management, and then solving problems. Pretty much it. That pretty much nails it down, I think.
There it is. And yeah. Q and I have known each other for quite some time now. We met on a plane, and I was in the middle seat, and Q had the window. Damn you. And we struck up a friendship around the fact that we are both incredibly interesting people, I say, in my humble opinion. But over the years that we've known one another, I can say that you remain, as close as we are among all of my friends that I have a closeness with, you remain the biggest mystery to me because you fluidly drift between one thing to another, all while maintaining and holding it all and talking at the highest level of each of them. So you consistently cause me to wonder what the hell is going on in your world. And most recently, our conversations have talked very much about research. And you are someone who approaches research in such a way that I can't even begin to understand how you approach it. So one of the things I want to talk to you about today, as somebody who myself, I do a lot of research, my team, we do a tremendous amount of research. I want to know how you approach research, what the mindset is as you go about building your team and helping other organizations build their team to think about things and look into things. How the hell are you approaching these sort of situations? How do you research? What's the starting point? What are the questions you ask? Go.
Go.
Is that a big enough question?
How do you solve the problems of the world? It's one of those kind of questions. Research, how do I go about, well, very personal, how do I go about research is, it's a mindset of exploration. They have this thing within, with children that they're studying right now, which is kind of this student-centered or interest-centered learning. And one of the guys who's been doing some work on it is Ricardo Semler out of Brazil. He runs Simco. And one of the things that he did when he wanted to build his organization, or as he built his organization, is he started doing the Bill and Melinda Gates thing, which is he started working on education. Because if he can understand education, then he can build a better employee, build a better business, et cetera. And one of the things he found was that he set a room up with all these toys and all these options for kids to do anything they wanted to do, video games, bicycle, skateboard, dolls, Legos, construction, whatever. Lego construction tools, anything. And whatever the child gravitates towards, we then teach everything around that from that standpoint. So, for instance, you are a social business entrepreneur and consultant, correct? Strategist, etc.
Oh, good. Yes.
From that point, you can talk about how being social, digitally and physically, affects and impacts your business as a whole. And since you have that very finite center, you have that anchor in the ground. We know how to pull everything in. I know how to talk to somebody who's very interested in video games about physics and about history and how these things are relevant to either creating better video games or video game play and strategy. That's kind of how I approach my research is I start with a very simple frame. And from simplicity, we go to complexity. And we figure out and the people that work with me, we go about the process of dissecting it. And the Stanford University with design thinking does a very good job of kind of architecting or creating the blueprint for this kind of thinking, this kind of dismantling. And that's where you lead to these rich conversations where you could be talking about a an enterprise software as a service application, and you can end up in a conversation about music, or you can end up in a conversation about manufacturing processes. And the real questions that your clients are actually asking your software as a service to answer. So when I start thinking about research, my goal is to get as complex as possible, because the more complex we get, the more improvisation, the more variables I introduce, when I come back to simplicity, it derives to a one-sentence insight. Who are these people? Well, why be social? You know, you're answering the question that your audience is actually asking versus the question that you want to answer. And it's the difference between being a business and being a teacher. A teacher will teach you what they have to teach. A business is here to answer the questions that you have to ask. And that's the fundamental piece of research. Research to potentiate business. If it's not potentiating business or potentiating a process, then the research is not doing its job.
So when we work with clients, many of the questions that we start out with are things along the lines of, you know, who is your audience? What is important to your audience? Where is your audience spending time, online, mm-hmm. offline? When your audience are in these places, online or offline, how are they behaving? What are their general behavioral tendencies? When we're approaching those sort of problems, we rely on big data sources that have already collected information, which have their flaws, but they also have, you know, obvious trends and things that we can learn. And then we look at small pieces of data to understand what their individual audience is doing. If you were to come into a situation like that where you have questions to answer about people's behaviors or things like that, mm-hmm. whether it be from a sales perspective or a content marketing perspective, what are some of the things that you would do that might fall outside of the things that I just described that we do?
Wow. The tools are very similar. So we'll take big data and we'll take these big, huge demographic pieces and some studies about, you know, all the rest of this work and all the rest of those things. Those are great. And those do a lot of spectacular things. But what I do that's different is we take that. Everybody takes the quantitative and goes to the qualitative. We just do that, or I do that by virtue of when I talk to the person, I'm not just interested in what they're doing with that particular product. I'm interested in what they're doing by function of their job, their career, and their advancement. And when we start talking about the advancement or the development of their expertise by utilizing our service or utilizing our software or utilizing anything, we can start to have much larger conversations that are way outside of this, that may be way outside of the scope of that particular software piece that we're actually doing the research on, but it begins to actually answer the fundamental question that they were coming back to get from that particular tool. So that's again why we would have offhanded comments about gingham check shirts or about you know, a particular type of vehicle or their particular Pinterest list and things of that nature that may be completely off topic, but it becomes way more telling. It becomes another point of interest about how they're actually using or how they're actually going about the service. And also it does a thing when you're actually doing a one-on-one conversation of distracting them, so that way you can ask a question that you didn't feel as though you got the answer you wanted before. So that's kind of a twofold thing.
So are you saying then in your research that sometimes you have questions that you may not actually be interested in the answer to, but rather more how it's answered in the context to distract someone so that when you can come back around to the important stuff, sort of like false flags or some sort of question that isn't there for the actual question you're trying to answer, but instead to open up thinking to a new way of connecting the dots?
Yes and no. Yes, I I definitely want to. There is a bend towards distracting, but that's – I am interested in their answer. I think that's the difference. And also, yes and no. No, not sometimes, all of the time. Whenever we're asking, I'm asking a question that, for lack of a better sense, may be off topic, but it's related to – it has the relationship back. And I think that's what I do that's different is I'm constantly looking for these disparate links in these otherwise distracting conversations that actually come back to the fundamental question I'm asking. And it gets out of my way. It gets me out of my way as well, which is instead of me looking for tons of confirmation bias in my research, I'm going around and actually by asking these other questions, I'm actually questioning my own questions. And therefore, I'm actually questioning my own questions, which then provides me a different lens to see the answers through.
That's actually a really interesting point because as I'm thinking about how we conduct research, and I'm glad you brought up the point about kind of confirmation bias and the perspective you're bringing, oftentimes we try to avoid making the mistake of thinking that everybody uses social media or that everybody in a particular demographic study is representative of the whole or things like that. I think it can be difficult. It's sort of – we've had this conversation before that like if you go to a WordPress developer, the answer is WordPress. If you go to a social media consultant, the answer is social media. So being able to challenge your own assumption that the solution that you have to the problem is actually the solution, how do you get yourself out of the way and understand what are the questions you need to ask to potentially disqualify yourself to find if you're even on the right track? How do you – what's the thought process that you go through?
The thought process I go through is, you try on what they're doing. So, try to walk in somebody else's shoes for a day, that kind of stuff. And I don't have a day. I have a few hours at most because the clock is running and the client is paying. But what you really do is, once you get all these things, you start creating these archetypes and you look through it. You look at it through their world. The response to most conversations are, or most asks of time are, I'm busy. And the question is, what's interesting to them that makes it so that you're a part of the I'm busy things that reject things that are not worthy of being busy for? And my thought process behind getting in their shoes really is to kind of say, if I'm looking at go-to-market solutions or go-to-market strategies, somebody's asking me about a go-to-market strategies problem. We want to go to market. We don't know who our audience is. We don't know what the potential highs, potential lows, and then we can start to forecast sales based upon these metrics and start to understand our marketing strategy and all the rest of that fun stuff. If I don't actually build that out for them, it makes it so that when they're asking for that specific thing, they might actually need to do three more things before we can start implementing WordPress as a solution. Before we can start saying to this that I'm not doing the hammer nail thing. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting there going, if you want this solution, this is where you need to be. And then it works best. It's one of the reasons why I work best with, I work best with styles of companies that are a little bit that are out of quote the startup phase, that have a little bit more funding, that have a little bit more of a swell to them, even if that funding is self-funding. I love it when companies are self-funded because it brings everything down to an ROI conversation immediately. You can't have any fluff conversations, but that's why I like that because you have the view of they've been out there, they've tried it, it's worked, it hasn't worked. You have the viewpoint of we've tried to pitch, we've pitched this thing, we're working, we're doing everything we can, and we need to grow. And you have these things working for you. So you have this information working for you. So when you go in to do your research, you're telling them things that they know, which is great. You're telling them things they don't know. That was a little bit of a deviation or a digression in the topic, but I'll take it for right now.
Sorry, it's kind of where it's going to go. But I'm actually going to pull the rug out and I'm going to shift topics real quick to an adjacent topic that's something else that's on my mind about what you do. You're very involved not just in research and helping companies identify the problem, solve the solutions, or provide the solution, solve the problems that they have, the questions they have, create relevant content, all that sort of good stuff that's research-based. But you're also one of your things we've really gotten into in recent months just in our conversations is around this idea of building a strong sales organization. And you've been studying the likes of people like Daniel Pink, and you've been reading books by people like Orrin Claff, and you've been looking at the psychology, the culture, the leadership aspects, and kind of the problem of what happens when a Steve Jobs leaves your company. How do you fill that gap, and how do you build a culture that's preparing for that? So I just wanted to check in with you and kind of hear about some of the things that you've been looking at that maybe you've been putting into a process or thinking about how you help organizations from a sales, marketing, business development perspective, really in their kind of not emergency preparedness, but just the preparedness that they need to survive as an organization and thrive.
That's a lot of question topics in there.
So let me back up. I'll say it's
no. Go for it.
Okay. So just what are you up to right now?
When it comes to sales, sell. I have this fantasy where I'm going to write a book that's just a book, and it just says sell, four letters with a period at the end. That's it. And it's just this idea that the presentation has started the moment the person agreed to having a sit down with you. So if we're talking and you go, wow, that's very interesting. Your presentation, your pitch that's happening in a week, your conversation that's happening in 3 months, your big pitch that's happening in 6 months started the moment they said yes. They may do a cursory view on LinkedIn to look at you, or they might do a quick search on Google to see where you're doing and all the rest of that fun stuff. But your presentation has begun. And that's the part that I think it's interesting about your world relative to social business, is that that's the piece that people are just getting a hold on at a personal level or a professional level. And they're really starting to understand it from a business level. And it's not necessarily the persona you want to put out there. It's what's out there. Want has nothing to do with it. There's tons of stuff out there that, you know, there's videos out there of me speaking that I don't necessarily want out there, but they're there. And it gives another view of my skill set and what I'm able to do. What I think with the sales conversation is, you know, when we start talking about Daniel Pink and Orrin Claff, you know, Daniel Pink saying that to sell is human, you know, the idea that you're constantly there is no off switch for this thing. You're always doing it. The fact that you don't do it is kind of is a maladjustment to our cultural psychology, to how we are. And Orrin Claff kind of saying, if you need to get this big thing sold, this is how you do it. This is the method, and that is all. Here's how you pitch. We're not talking about anything else. And I'm interested in that conversation between the two. You might put Simon Sinek in there with the leader start with why. And that's where I started to ask the questions about, well, if you're intrigued by why, you get your yes with why, you sell on how, and you're selling on how. I forgot the person who coined that off the top of my head, but you sell with how. And then, you know, you have all this rapport building in between hand. Orrin Claff will tell you rapport building is not even necessary. Well, that's because he's at the last stage when all that's left is the close. They should be on board. You should already have all these folks set, and the only thing that should be happening at that point is your close. With sales, it's very interesting. It's very interesting the way these things go, because if you look at an Apple, they sell without necessarily selling. They're a testament to the power of a brand, and I like watching Apple as they shift from a Jobsian design thinking, or, you know, everybody's like, he's a visionary. Well, he's a designer. He's an Elon Musk, if you will. He's a designer. He's thinking about what's happening way ahead. He's anticipating your needs and giving you solutions to those things that you didn't even know were problems. Whereas I look at Tim Cook as management, and that's not a bad thing. Management is what keeps it so that we're still having conversations about HP and Dell. They don't have to do anything particularly innovative. They just have to respond to market demands. What the market is saying, you know, Apple's coming out with the Apple Wallet 2 years, quote unquote, late, but they're just responding to the market. You know, they're taking a sleek design product, putting an application in there that responds to the market, responds to where everything's going. And right now, Apple's a big response company instead of being a big lead company, leading indicator company. You can see where the market's going by virtue of Apple. Whereas when Microsoft is switching now to Nadella, as their chief executive officer, who's kind of steeped in the wool of Microsoft, but is very forward-thinking, you can already see the cultural shift in how they're doing things, how Microsoft is integrated with Google, and they're coming out with the HoloLens and all the rest of that fun stuff. This is getting a little bit out of selling, but it still is. Because again, your selling has started from the moment they said the first yes. It's already there.
So, okay, one, I have at least 100 questions that came out of everything you just said. But so here's my challenge for you in this. And this is kind of where I think you and I, when we get together, we think about everything from today to 50 years in the future, the singularity. I mean, we will go to every length about things and we think big thoughts. Mm-hmm. And knowing what we go through as a social business agency to even try and communicate that social is bigger than social media marketing, that there's social selling, social recruiting, it's, there's these big things. And we have to break down this big idea into these smaller chunks. You just gave a look at sales that encompasses everything that is sales. I mean, we are talking about you, whether it be you as a person or the company entity, in its total view of itself on the web and in the world, that which they have control over and that which they do not. You're talking about the lead up process to the last mile that Oren and the pitch and things like that would talk about with the close and the pitch and that last section. You're talking about absolutely everything. So as somebody who's working with companies, I guess my question to you is, you can't possibly bring in that level of sales conversation without making someone's head explode who's not used to having these kind of conversations with you. So how do you show people the process, and where do you start with this idea that sales is not just, you know, it's not just the rapport building, or it's not just the pitch, but that it's everything. It's who you represent in the narrative that you're telling. It's the narrative that's been told about you. It's the lead up and rapport building from the moment they said, yes, I'm interested, down to the pitch, to the follow up, to how you, it's all of these things. How do you open that conversation? Yes. How do you open that?
When was the last time you bought a car?
I zip car now. I don't even.
Why do you zip car?
Because it's convenient and it's easy and I don't have to pay for a car or insurance every month. I just get it when I need it.
What do you use a car for?
To get from point A to point B, typically for client meetings. Point B is typically a client. Otherwise, I don't leave the city. Everything outside the city is hot lava.
What kind of – do you use a specific kind of zip car?
If I'm feeling classy, I go with the Cadillac. I feel like driving around in a go-kart, I go for the Mini. And if I'm just feeling cheap, I go for some sort of a lightweight SUV that's at the lowest price point.
Because context matters.
Yes, absolutely.
And therefore, in the specific context, the specific content matters.
Yes.
Right. So you start the conversation there. By establishing the context, that the content becomes necessary. And then from there, you can spin out. And people are like, you're going to spin out of control. It's going to go all over the place. The biggest, my view right now, and my view that's developed over the past 15 or so years, is that if it is not contrived, if you don't have a process in place for it, then you've missed something. There is no supposed to. It's not doing anything. There's no plan. Your business should be structured in such a way. Not should. Your business is structured in such a way that when, and this is the part that makes research so important, and that it's that potentiating factor. When you've done research and you know about these other things, it's not a shock that they're going in that direction. They're going in that direction, and here's our answer to it. We're going in this direction, and this is our answer to it. When I start asking you questions about, well, what do you use it for, point A to point B, what is point B, client meeting, do you use different kind? I know about Zipcar, so I can start asking questions about, what do you use a specific kind of car? And that lets me know that there are now three different answers, that there are three different styles of Jeff's yes. I have three yeses for Jeff, okay, along with the fundamental convenience. Okay, so if I meet the first yes, which is I agree to, now the question is I have these three levels of yes. One yes, if I get it, I'm going to get this, you know, $8 an hour number. The next yes, if I get it, I'm going to get a $10 an hour number. But this third yes, if I get that one, I'm going to get a $16 or $18 an hour number, which is how much, you know, Zipcar respectively may or may not charge depending on geographic location. So if I know those questions, then I know that when I'm pitching or when I'm throwing out an ad campaign or I'm doing marketing or I'm being social out there, I know that if I don't have huge budget and I want to get, you know, I just want to get Jeff involved, then I'm going to pitch always for that $7 or $8 one. It's real easy. He needs it for to running around. But if I know I have enough, if I have enough cash and I want to get that big dollar, then, you know, then I'm going to go for this. I'm going to go over to this larger campaign or vice versa. Some people really hedge on having these big, huge, want to get these big, huge, you know, these 18, you know, this $18 an hour, if this is a Zipcar conversation, this piece. So then everything must be organized around that. And you must go back to here to get to here. And most people think about, well, we're going to go after Procter & Gamble. That's great. Who are you going after in Procter & Gamble? Well, we need to get the decision maker. Who? Like, who is that person? Have you found that out? Who is the actual person? And go after that person, realizing that it may be you might get three versions of a yes, and there might be three other people involved in that. And your question while going through this, while going through this process, and while researching and understanding all these pieces and these and how they work together, is to really formulate yourself so you have responses for all of these things. Yes.
So you get brought into an organization and you see that, and they're bringing you in for sales help. There's obviously the who's your audience, what do they need, what's the solution? Mm-hmm. There's that piece of it, of the sales. Mm-hmm. How do you or I guess, is there a priority to all of those other pieces though? So sales, when you're brought in for sales, I guess, let me back up. Here's my thought. When we come in and we want to talk about social business, our prospects don't want to talk about social business. They want to talk to us about social media marketing. So we know that we have to come in and first talk about social media marketing in order to get to the point where we can show them how social tools allow them to collaborate internally better or to provide or to more effectively recruit. You know, how do you use tools for recruiting and for telling the story about the internal culture, et cetera. So we know that that's our pathway in. When you're talking to organizations about sales to build a world-class sales organization and you've got these things about who you are on the web that you know about and you've, you know, it's yours versus who you are on the web that you don't know about and what people know about, what's the information that's out there that you want and don't want, what's the story you're telling, then there's that lead up, you find that person at Procter & Gamble, what's that lead up piece, and then how are you going to pitch them? What's your starting point with them? Is there a prioritization to all of this? Or do you just come in, assess, I guess, where the biggest gaping holes are? Or do you feel that there's sort of foundations that need to be built first? You know, do you come in and say, here's how you're going to pitch them when you get to that last section? Okay, now let's look at how you are perceived on the web. Or is it first we got to get how you're perceived on the web under control so you can even get to that conversation? Is there an order to it that you typically go through? Do you have a process that's been built or set the way you do it, or is it completely guided by context of the particular opportunity?
I lean more towards the latter summary, which is it's based upon the context of what's going on. And I spend a lot of my time with to understand how the executive team or how the development team perceives how they look. And then my goal is to get connected with old and new faces to see how they look. Not just through my eyes, but how, you know, my initial response to the website is, this website's gross. I think it needs to change and we need to do this, this, and this. However, to the audience they're talking to, that website is the reason why they love that website. So again, I want to get past this confirmation bias and get into what their audience is responding to. Would their audience be bigger if they changed their website, if they added something to it, if they went out and did a campaign if they did a closed group campaign, you know, if they implemented something like, you know, I shudder to utter this word, but Ning, a Ning-like, social media platform, a networking platform, on their site where they can have people that would talk about this thing connect with one another? Does that need to be physical as well? Everybody's going nuts with conferences. So we start with the context, the context of where they are, and then from there, building the most substantive content that we can, by virtue of the client. So yeah, we start with your perception, and then we jump into reality and what people are actually seeing. And generally, your public will tell you in so many words what you're missing. They may see a gaping hole. And your answer to that gaping hole is $50,000, when actually to answer that particular issue would be, well, what if they did this? Oh, well, then that's not a problem anymore. And that's a $10,000 hole or a $10,000 cost for the company versus the $50,000. Or it might be you want to do a simple, you know, $5,000 back-end switch for your credit card processing, and that actually doesn't solve any of the – that solves one particular issue. But when you go to step – you know, go to step out into the forest again, you're just going to run into more trees. So you actually don't have a $5,000 problem. You have a $60,000 problem that you need to – your organization needs to go pitch what you currently have to a funder. So then that causes you to right your ship so that you look good for – which by proxy does a lot to build the substance that you're going to use later – in campaigns. Does that make sense?
I think so.
We're constantly coming back to a very, very simple thing, which is your company substantive at what it does? Is it the expert, right? Or, you know, do people view you that way? And we're constantly asking that question. And, you know, what can we do to make it so that you are? Or you should be in the conversation. We're talking about operating systems. Are you in the mobile operating systems? Are you in the iOS, Android conversation windows? If you asked a year and a half ago, no. But are you asking today? Well, maybe. There's a little bit of conversation. People are saying a thing or two. Not anything big. But if they keep going, analysts are kind of saying, like, hey, you should probably take a look at these guys.
Fair.
So.
All right, man. Well, I want to switch to something else because this is and kind of a little bit on a less heavy topic because I think it's something that I've always been curious about with you. As you know, I live on the internet. I am on here all day, every day. I'm perpetually connected. I've always got something that I'm looking at or seeing or sharing with people. Some people look to me as their sole source of news. I guess my question for you is – I'm serious, man.
You've turned yourself into the social business John Stewart.
It's true, man. People will find out all manner of things from BuzzFeed-like content and superhero-related stuff all the way to the deepest recesses of the social business world. But I look at a lot of stuff, man. I see a lot of viral campaigns. I see a lot of excellent advertising. I see all sorts of really, really cool stuff on the web. And of all of the people that I'm connected to, and I have a pretty substantial network, you are the one person that will always drop something in my inbox. And I'm like, where are you finding these things? You will find these incredible examples of companies doing things that nobody's ever seen do in marketing. They do web projects. You send me web projects that I can't even comprehend how they've built such things. And that it loads so quickly. You introduce me to companies that are marketing themselves in such ways that I now use them as case studies. So thank you for that, because if I did not have you, I would not have certain examples to draw from. But here's the kind of the overarching theme here. You are basically the deep web for the not deep web. And I want to know what the hell you're looking at and how you can be this alternative news feed for me of things that nobody else is bringing to my attention amidst all of the people I interact with. Where are you on the web, and can I go there?
Well, you can always find me at my website, qxavier.com, but you won't find generally – you'll find kind of what's floating around my mind on my blog section, but that's not really going to give you what I'm looking at.
Yeah, I want to know where these obscure Instagram campaigns come from, these ridiculous websites, these YouTube videos that are not optimized for any search. They just have like a string of characters and numbers, and you're like, check it out. It's cool. And it is. Where – how
– Yeah, no.
Do you have a queue of your own that sends you things, and then you just pass it off to me, and I think you're awesome? Or are you just exploring the weirdest crap on the web?
The best way to explain it is I use what you use. I just spin it out in a different way. And that is to say, I'm on Tumblr, I'm on Instagram, I'm on StumbleUpon, I'm on all these things. I'll be on TED. I'm not speaking on TED, but I'm on TED, or I'm on YouTube and all the rest of these things. And I'm looking, and again, if we're having a conversation about this thing, drone flight, human flight assisted by drones. So that's one of the things I saw recently was a guy built a mock-up of a carriage that goes on an oversized drone so that human beings can fly. So like no more rocket pack. Now we're flying via drone remote control sitting here and you just steer with the controller and you fly around. You fly around now with the drone. Awesome. Then it's like, okay, so then the question becomes FAA regulations, helmet safety protocols. I wonder about, and then you start asking like really weird questions like, well, if he's doing that, what kind of controller is he using? How does that actually work? How does he keep it level? Are the gyros in the drone have to be recalibrated to deal with the extra ballast of the human being? Or is there a separate gyro? Like, and you start asking all these other questions, and it's just because I'm constantly asking these questions, or constantly looking in these other areas, I will go, if I'm looking, so then I start looking down the remote control, I start looking down radio frequency. When I look down radio frequency, I find a piece about, some whiz-bang piece or some offhand piece about how radio frequencies are affecting the brain. Well, then we start asking questions about, well, if radio frequencies affect the brain in a negative way, do they affect the brain in a positive way? By the way, we started talking about drone flight with human beings attached. Now we're over into neuroscience and talking about how radio waves. Well, then you start getting into subdermal electrostimulation because we're talking about radio frequencies affecting the brain. They start talking about how the brain is affected by radio waves. Well, that's really electricity. So then you start looking at these people who are using electrostimulation to affect parts of the brain and increase cognitive responses. Well, if you can increase cognitive responses, can we use something similar? You know, what part of the brain do they affect? If you're looking at parts of brain they affect, then you start looking at, well, can somebody do that? Since we're talking about radio waves and electric, can somebody do that with their voice? Or can sound do that? Well, sound can do that. So then it's, well, is it your pitch? Or is it what you're saying? Or is it the structure in which you say it? Well, then you start having a conversation about persuasion. And then that comes back to sales.
And drone flights.
And now
flights.
We're back at sales from drone flights.
Yeah.
And it's like this big, weird, tripped out loop that happens. But at the end of the day, it always comes, not always, but it'll come back to something that, again, we talk about interest-led learning. It'll come back to that centralized interest area.
So are you following the signals and the next pathways that they're giving you algorithmically, or are you into a subject and then all of a sudden you're smacked by something else that's related and tied together in the way that your brain is wired? Like how are you – because what you're saying is basically here's my rabbit hole, right? I go on YouTube and I do praying mantis versus tarantula, and then I'm on – for a half an hour on YouTube about different insects and animals fighting one another. And then I feel completely bathed in self-loathing for the time I've wasted. But you're using it productively to go from drone flights to neurocognition and sales. How are you drawing the link between those two, whereas I am just caught into this animal fighting animal pit of hell?
I don't look as the internet as a form of entertainment. I look at it as a way for me to learn.
I guess that's probably the biggest difference right there. I mean, honestly, that sounds like one of the biggest differences. I'm not trying to learn anything. I just want to see which one of them wins that fight. But you are actually looking to link things to things to things, and then eventually you come upon a gem and you realize that's where I need to dig in.
Yeah, one of the most misunderstood things about reductionist theory, like everything coming back to a single point, is that once you get back to the single point, that it's over. Once you get back to the single point, it now goes back out to complexity. It's like we don't know what's on the other side of a black hole. We just know at the center of it, there is a singularity. Or we we hypothesize that there is. On the other side of that could be a whole another universe. And what I say is that once we start over here and we start from this, you know, this one centralized topic, we expand the complexity, we get it back down to simplicity, we then are given the opportunity to expand it again. You know, I could, and it's not something, maybe it's something unique to me. Maybe it's not. I've met other people like this, so I don't think it is. If you go to any account planner at an advertising agency or any strategic planner at a consumer insights group, you'll probably find four or five people like me who just ruminate on things. You know, I'll watch a YouTube clip, you know, praying mantis versus what was the reference?
Tarantula. It was praying mantis versus tarantula. Although it messed a mouse up like real bad, and it's just a praying mantis.
Well, it's that natural curiosity, when you're, you know, when you can first speak and you start asking why are praying mantis and tarantulas fighting in the first place? Or was it something that we did where we started putting them together and they just started naturally fighting one another, or, you know, things like nature? So now you have the culture driving, putting those two together, or you have just the environment that they're in naturally. They naturally meet in the jungle. Well, where do they exist? Well, what's going on there? Well, what makes it so that they survive? What makes it so that they thrive, et cetera? With the, you know, why is the culture dictating that, you know, we want to put a praying mantis and a tarantula in a cage together and have them fight, or a very small cage?
Here's what I think. I think we should never let them figure out a way to take IBM's Watson and merge it with your brain, because we're going to get that artificial intelligence that will realize that human beings are not necessary, and we'll have Ultron, and that's it. I think that's what
human beings.
I just think we can't combine your brain with Watson. I think that that's just a bad idea, and I think that's a good note for us to end it on, because
we
got to do that, man.
As soon as you start talking about artificial intelligence.
No, I know, because we could go off on a whole rabbit hole, but we got to wrap on this one. We are going to come back and talk about artificial intelligence, because I have a feeling that in the next several months, it's going down. Something's going down. I don't know, but also
there's a massive disruption that will be taking place relative, not necessarily artificial intelligence, because we don't have a theory of mind that functions yet, but we will have a density of algorithms that interrelate logically and disparately in such a way that it will look like we can't make somebody smarter, but I can give you all the biomarkers of increased intelligence. Focus, concentration, all the rest of those, memory recall. We can supplement you. We can do subdermal stimulation. We can do everything to give you the look of or the feel of being smarter or the feel of listening. It's like the tricks people tell you. Look in somebody's eyes. They'll feel as though you're paying attention. You're not actually paying attention. You're just looking in their eyes. All right. So it's all the pieces of intelligence without that, because we don't have a theory of intelligence expansion that works yet. So I think we're going to, when it's talked about artificial intelligence, we're going to have pieces that look really incredibly robust. And you're going to be like, you're not almost going to be able to distinguish from a sentient being. And that's going to happen, I think, very soon.
Well, we're going to talk about that after May 1st, the day before my birthday, when the Age of Ultron comes out. I'm going to go see it on the first day it's out, because you know how I do. And then after you've seen it, we will regroup and we will talk about artificial intelligence, the future, wearables, all manner of other things. This has been episode two.
Why don't we just do this consistently?
We should. That's the point. We are going to do this more consistently. This is your second podcast episode.
Yes.
You need to go ahead and build that muscle. So for all the people out there, where should they go and be social with you, Mr. Q Xavier?
I'm available on Twitter at Q Xavier. That's QXAVIER. Once you've gotten that down, that is also my website address, qxavier.com. And then I can also be seen on the Instagram where I might drop little backdrop thought nuggets, things that pop into my mind on there. I use that for Twitter as well. It just depends. And so that's Instagram, that's Twitter. Facebook, you can find me, but it's not a good place to find me.
Fair point. It's all going in the show notes.
What's that?
It's all going in the show notes so that people can find you and postulate with you and find out where the hell you are on the internet and what you're doing. So, Q, thank you for being on for your second episode. This has been Conversations. I'm Jeff. That's Q. This is what we do.
If I could say one more thing.
Please do.
I'm sorry. Before you close out. I could summarize all of the research and all of the sales into one very, very simple thing, into one very, very simple phrase, but that it's going to take, it takes forever to actually show that you do this. And I'm going to curse right now, but it's give a shit.
I love it.
Give a shit. If you could just give an entire shit about your clients and about your client, about the potential customers and about your product, and that's the point of stalling, just give a shit, it will begin the conversations that you really need to have.
I dig it.
About what you are and what you're doing.
And on that note, I may decide to change the title of this podcast episode from Q's second podcast to Q's second podcast, Giving a Shit.
Yeah.
So that's how
we do. That's where everything is, man. Just care. Give a shit.
Just care. And for everybody out there, thank you for listening. This has been Jeff. This has been Q.
Thank you kindly.
Thanks again for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed that episode of Conversations. Be sure to go over to iTunes or Stitcher and give us a rating. Tell us what you love about the show, what you hate about the show. And we hope you come back for our next episode. Take care.